delights. I love the characters of the Bible and reading about them and seeing what we can learn from them. So we've been on a faith journey. We started with Abel. We've gone went to Enoch. We went to Abraham and Sarah. We went on to Isaac and Jacob. Last week was Joseph. We weren't here, but I'm told Mike, he preached with great enthusiasm. And then today, we've come to two nameless characters in the Bible, in this Hebrews 11 portion. And I've been kind of fussing over this. And why did God put these two nameless individuals in this great hall of faith, as we call it, Hebrews 11? Why are they there in the first place? Who are they? And what can we learn from them? So before, hopefully I've piqued your interest as to who they are. but I just want to set the scene a little bit before we get to them. So we're going to read a bit of a chunky portion of scripture. If you could turn with me to Acts 7. And we're going to start from verse 3. This is Stephen. He was a deacon in the early church. And he was preaching to the Sanhedrin in Jerusalem. It was actually his last preach because afterwards he was stoned. And he gives a lovely summary of Exodus 1 to 14. So I don't have to read 14 chapters to you now. We can just read a bit of a summary just to set the scene. Okay, so let's have a look. So it's Acts 7 verse 3. So it's God speaking to Abraham. He says, "They leave your country and your people," God said, "and go to the land I will show you." You know, Thomas spoke on that. So he left the land of the Chaldeans and settled in Haran. After the death of his father, God sent him to this land where you are now living. So that would be Israel, Jerusalem, where Stephen is preaching at that point. He gave him, that's now Abraham, no inheritance here, not even ground to set his feet upon. He had a nomadic sort of an existence. But God promised him that he and his descendants after him would possess the land, even though at that time Abraham had no child. God spoke to him in this way. And this is an important prophecy that God speaks over Abraham's descendants. "And for 400 years, your descendants will be strangers in a country not their own, and they will be enslaved and mistreated." Not really what you'd like to hear about your descendants. "But I will punish the nation they serve as slaves," God said. "And afterward they will come out of that country and worship me in this place." Then he gave Abraham the covenant of circumcision. And Abraham became the father of Isaac and circumcised him 8 days after his birth. Later, Isaac has Jacob. Jacob has 12 sons. 12 sons are jealous of, or 11 of them, are, or 10 of them are jealous of the one, Joseph, who was the favorite son. And Joseph, we learned, you heard last week, was sold into slavery. And it looked like everything was going bad. But that verse 9 there, it says, "But God was with him and rescued him from his troubles." Over and over again, in part of his household, in the prison, God was with him and rescued him because God had a plan for his life. And God gave Joseph wisdom and enabled him to gain the goodwill of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. So Pharaoh made him ruler over Egypt and all his palace. And God set him up there. We know that Pharaoh had dreams, and Joseph was able to interpret those dreams about a famine that was coming in the land. And that was the reason why God had sent Joseph to Egypt in the first place, prepared him, taken him through the difficulties, because he knew that a famine was coming, and Egypt was the one, at least Joseph was the one that God gave the plan to be able to store up all the good of during the good years, all the produce, and then in the bad years there would be enough food for the people, not only of Egypt, but actually God was taking care of his people, his Israelites. So it goes on to say that Jacob and his 75 offspring at that point all moved to Egypt, and God looked after them in that place. But there was always a promise that there was another promised land. This wasn't going to be their final destination. So we pick it up from verse 17. "As the time drew near for God to fulfill his promise to Abraham, the number of our people in Egypt had greatly increased. Then a new king, to whom Joseph meant nothing, came to power in Egypt. He dealt treacherously with our people and oppressed our ancestors by forcing them to throw out their newborn babies so that they would die. At that time, Moses was born, and he was no ordinary child. For 3 months, he was cared for by his family. When he was placed outside, Pharaoh's daughter took him and brought him up as her own. Moses was educated in all the wisdom of the Egyptians and was powerful in speech and action. When Moses was 40 years old, he decided to visit his own people, the Israelites. He saw one of them being mistreated by an Egyptian. So he went to his defense and avenged him by killing the Egyptian. Moses thought that his own people would realize that God was using him to rescue them, but they did not. The next day, Moses came upon two Israelites who were fighting. He tried to reconcile them by saying, "Men, you are brothers. Why do you want to hurt each other?" But the man who was mistreating the other pushed Moses aside and said, "Who are you, ruler and judge? So who made you ruler and judge over us? Are you thinking of killing me as you killed the Egyptian yesterday?" When Moses heard this, he fled to Midian, where he settled as a foreigner and had two sons. After 40 years had passed, an angel appeared to Moses in the flames of a burning bush in the desert near Mount Sinai. When he saw this, he was amazed at the sight. As he went over to get a closer look, he heard the Lord say, "I am the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob." Moses trembled with fear and did not dare to look. Then the Lord said to him, "Take off your sandals, for the place where you are standing is holy ground. I have indeed seen the oppression of my people in Egypt. I have heard their groaning and have come down to set them free. Now come, I will send you back to Egypt." This is the same Moses they had rejected with the words, "Who made you ruler and judge?" He was sent to be their ruler and deliverer by God himself, through the angel who appeared to him in the bush. He led them out of Egypt and performed wonders and signs in Egypt, at the Red Sea, and for 40 years in the wilderness. This is the Moses who told the Israelites, "God will raise up for you a prophet like me from among your own people." So that alludes to Moses pointing forward to Jesus, who was going to be the ultimate deliverer. And that's a beautiful study. I don't have time to do that, but maybe you can study how Moses points towards Jesus in many ways. So let's just go back to my original thing. Who are the nameless people in Hebrews 11? So we're going to just look now at Hebrews 11, 23. Just turn there. Okay. By faith, Moses' parents hid him for 3 months after he was born, because they saw he was no ordinary child, and they were not afraid of the king's edict. So who are the nameless two? They're Moses' parents. Does anybody by any chance know their names? If you go to Exodus 6 verse 20, there's one little portion that mentions their name. It says that these were the clans of Levi, according to their records. Amram, A-M-R-A-M, Amram, married his father's sister, that would be his aunt. So hopefully she was a light lamaki, otherwise she was rather old wife. So that was Jochebed, and who bore him Aaron and Moses, and they only mentioned the guys in these portions, but there was Miriam as well, and Amram lived 137 years. Okay, so we know that the two nameless people in this great hall of faith are Amram and Jochebed. And now the question is why are they named in this hall of faith together with all these famous people that we know all about? And what faith lessons can we learn about them? So what do we know about them? First of all, they're both from the tribe of Levi. Secondly, we know that they were both slaves. They had a bitter, bitter life. They were working under very harsh conditions. They were enslaved in Egypt. So we remember what I've just read there, just to reiterate there, Jacob with his 75-odd descendants went to Egypt, and God blessed them there. They multiplied and multiplied and multiplied, and one of the verses says that there were so many of them, they just filled the whole of Egypt. And so Pharaoh started getting a bit anxious about this. He was first of all jealous of them, I think, with the way that they multiplied, but he was also anxious that they might team up together with some of Egypt's enemies outside of Egypt, and then there would be big troubles. So he started instituting some plans. And his first plan was that he was going to subject them to slavery, to very harsh labor. But that plan failed, because the Bible says that the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied. So then he had plan B, and this was getting the Hebrew midwives. He said to them, he instructed them, at the time of birth, when you are helping the Hebrew mothers to birth the babies, if you see that it's a male child, you have to kill that baby right on the spot. Did that plan work? No. And by God's grace, those midwives feared God more than they did Pharaoh, and they allowed the boy children to live. Then the third plan of Pharaoh was, he said to all his people, that would be Egyptians and Israelites, all the people in Egypt, he said to them, if you see a Hebrew baby boy, you're going to take that boy and you're going to throw him into the river Nile. So the rationale in this thing was that if there are no Hebrew boys for the Hebrew girls to marry, that they would either have to marry Egyptian boys, and then the wealth of the Israelites would become the Egyptians, and they would be assimilated into their culture, or they just wouldn't marry at all, and then that would be the end of the Israelites, that they would become extinct. So Amram and Jochebed had already had Aaron and Miriam, we saw. And now in this climate, this climate of oppression and actual raw fear, they found out, well, Jochebed is pregnant. And there were no ultrasounds in those times, so you couldn't check the gender of the baby. So I can just imagine for 9 months the agony that they must have gone through waiting as this baby grew inside of them. And was this going to be a boy or girl? And if this baby was a boy, what were they going to do? Because the punishment, according to one of the historians that I read up on, for anybody, any parent disobeying the order of Pharaoh to chuck their child into the river, was that their whole household would be killed. So it would be then. So in other words, if they had a little boy and they kept that boy and it was discovered, then Jochebed, Amram, Aaron, Miriam, and the baby would all be killed. So quite a dilemma that they found themselves in. So what faith lessons can we learn from Jochebed and Amram? When the fateful day of that delivery came, there was a great joy of a baby being born. But I can just imagine the sinking, like, realization that happened when they realized that this was a baby boy. But they saw something else. And this was, it's written there that they saw that he was no ordinary boy. He was no ordinary baby. And I was thinking about this thing. What parents, who of you, when your baby is born, thinks, oh, it's just another ordinary baby? You know, it's precious. This baby's precious. We waited for that baby. It's a little bit of a combination of both of you. It's a precious baby. So, you know, no baby's really ordinary. So was this baby a bit strange? Did it have like 15 toes instead of 10? Or what was it? Or did it have some sort of stamp on its forehead that made it look like, you know, I'm different? What was it that actually set this child apart? I was looking at some other translations just to try and understand this. Other translations say he was a fine child. The Amplified says he was especially beautiful and healthy. The Revised Standard Version says he was beautiful before God. And the Syriac version, I'd never heard of that before, but he was dear to God. So faith sees. My first point is faith sees. And faith sees God, first of all, and it sees the way that God sees. I remember being younger and wrestling with the thing of faith. Like, how do I make myself believe more? How do I conjure faith up inside of me? Is there something of a positive thinking or like getting yourself to get this faith? But I've learned over time that faith is looking at God. It's seeing God. It's seeing him. It's seeing his beauty. It's seeing its worth. It's meditating on who he is and then asking him to transform the way that I see. So seeing the way that he sees. And something happened here. We see that Amram and Jochebed saw their baby the way that God saw their baby. Now, I just did a little bit of digging around just in some of the historical writings around this time. And just by the by, there's an actually wonderful website. It's called www.biblestudytools.com, which is a wonderful tool. It gives you Bible dictionaries, gives you commentaries from easy ones where you just go verse by verse to big, massive volumes. It gives you preachers, and it gives you historical books as well. One of them is this Antiquities of the Jews, and it's written by a man, Flavius Josephus. He's a well-known historian. And in book 2, chapter 9, this is what he writes about Amram. He says, And it's translated into kind of Shakespearean English, so I'll read a bit and then summarize it a bit. So it says, a man whose name was Amram, one of the noblest sorts of the Hebrews. And what he's meaning by that is, if you look at Joshua 24:14, Joshua spoke there about, it wasn't all the Hebrews weren't calling out to the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob to come and deliver them. There were many of them that had bowed their knees to the Egyptian deities. They were bowing down to other gods. But Amram wasn't one of those. He was one of the nobler sort. He was crying out to God. He says he was afraid for his whole nation, lest it should fail by the want of young men to be brought up hereafter. And he was very uneasy of it, his wife being then with child, and he knew not what to do. Hereupon he betook himself to prayer to God. Just that he knew not what to do, and his response was he betook himself to prayer to God. So what is our response when we don't know what to do, when we're in a tiz? Do we rush to this one, rush to that one? Do we fall on the heap, on the floor? Do we betake ourselves? Do we take ourselves to prayer to God, to inquire of him? And he entreated him to have compassion, and he carries on, and he's crying out to God, and he's crying out to God to have understanding of what's going on, and crying out to God that God would abort this plan, this wicked, wicked plan of Pharaoh to do what he's doing, this evil thing of the murdering of the children. Basically, he comes to Amram in a dream, and he says to him that this child that he is carrying is actually the deliverer, God's promised deliverer. And he shall be concealed from those who watch to destroy him. And when he is brought up in a surprising way, which we'll hear about, he shall deliver the Hebrew nation from the distress they are under from the Egyptians. His memory shall be famous while the world lasts. And he carries on with some more things. Now, this is a historical manuscript. It's not the Bible. So maybe it happened, maybe it didn't happen. But what we do know is that Amram and Jochebed would have heard the prophecy that I alluded to in Acts 17. So God came to Abraham, remember, with a prophecy about his descendants. He said for 400 years they were going to be strangers in a country they didn't know, which we now know as Egypt. And they were going to be oppressed, which we've heard about now. But God promised that there would be a deliverer. And that bit of information would have been handed over from Abraham to Isaac, from Isaac to Jacob, Jacob to Levi, Levi to Amram, and the few in between. I don't know who they are in between. Okay, so we do know whether he had the dream or not, whether God gave him that specific promise or not, they would have been calculating, and they would have been seeing, it's time. He would have been in, especially in this, as things are hotting up within Egypt, there would have been a crying out to God for this deliverer and waiting for God's plan and for God's deliverer to come. So faith sees. However, it happened. Amram and Jochebed saw their baby, and they saw the way that God saw that baby, and they knew that God had a special plan for their baby. And I just want to stop here and say, those of you moms and dads who are pregnant, those of you maybe that are considering becoming parents, those of you that are who are parents already, are you inquiring of God about your baby or about your child? Are you asking God, what is the destiny that he has put into them? Because Moses was one of many that God uses. Each one of you, we are priests. God has a purpose for each one of us and each one of our children. And even in the giving of names, I was thinking that often in the Bible, the giving of names is significant. And nowadays, maybe we think, that's old-fashioned. But I just want to, when we were expecting our children, we asked God for names for our girls. And I hope I don't embarrass them, but I'm just going to say a little bit about why we chose their names and something of putting faith within us to pray over our children. So our firstborn is Caitlin, and that means pure. And Zoe is her second name, and that means life, or the life of God. And we've seen from a little age, she's actually very truthful, from almost brutally honest, very truthful. And it's actually been such a joy to see. And there's been a times when we've wondered if she will choose the right way. But she has chosen God, and it has been a beautiful thing to see the life of God in her and to see the life of God flowing out of her and for her to use the gift of writing that she has to bless people. But that's our Caitlin Zoe. And then our second child, Bonnie. Bonnie means fair, good, beautiful, cheerful, which is really what she's like. But the second name we gave her was Jade, and it's actually the stone Jade represents healing. And I had a miscarriage after Caitlin, and then Bonnie came along. I was sick during the pregnancy as well. And so she was something of a healing within me. But actually, we saw, you know, many of you know that Bonnie became ill. She went into chronic renal failure. And many of you have journeyed that journey together with us of her healing by having a transplant. And many of you have been asking me how it's going. It's now, it happened in November. It's now in March, and she's doing really well. She's at Varsity, and she'll be here on Easter Sunday together with us. So we rejoice in that. But, you know, the whole thing of healing has been something that we've been taking on a journey, understanding how God heals. And also she's studying occupational therapy, so there's something of a healing, I believe, that God has in her destiny. And then our Jody comes after Judah or Judith, and that's praise. From a little girl, she had the hallelujah heart. She had a hallelujah heart. She praised God, and God has gifted her musically. Her second name is Janita, which is God is gracious. And so we are praying over her, the destiny of God in her life. So I encourage you, ask God about your children. He made them. He created them with a purpose. Ask God how to parent your child with destiny, that they don't just be children that survive and exist, but they actually be children that live for God, that advance the kingdom of God whilst alive. Okay, so Amram and Jochebed, first of all, we learn from them that God, that faith sees. It sees God. It sees the way that God sees. Then the second point we can learn from them is that faith acts on what it sees. So it says there, by faith, Moses' parents hid him for 3 months after he was born. It took faith for them not to throw their baby into the river. I mean, it would have been an awful thing to do, but it took faith to overcome fear of the consequences of not doing so. James 2 verse 17 says, faith by itself, if it is not accompanied by action, is dead. Then also faith risks. It overcomes fear. By faith, Moses' parents were not afraid of the king's edict. Faith chooses dependence on God. So at 3 months, we don't know why then exactly. I think it's jolly difficult to keep a tiny baby, the presence of a baby, quiet. Any of you been night and day, baby having croup or baby hungry, wailing, you know, it's really difficult to keep them quiet. So if something happened at 3 months, whether it was God that was prompting them or whether they got word that somebody maybe was, you know, leaking out the fact that Moses was in the household. But they took the step of faith to build a little boat, a little basket boat. They lined it so that it would be waterproof. And they take this precious baby and put it in this basket boat and go and put it in the Nile of all places. I mean, I think I would have run the opposite direction. I would have run and tried and find a mountain somewhere far away. I don't know. But they took it and actually put it in the very place that the other children were being thrown and meeting their death. They put the baby there by faith. They took that risk and they put the baby there in that little basket boat. By faith, Miriam, who's the older sister, stood guard. And can you imagine, big sisters, can you imagine the scene? Your little baby brother's in this little boat there, bobbing around there in the reeds, and you see, of all people, Pharaoh's daughter coming along with her entourage of ladies-in-waiting along the riverbed there, and you see her coming closer and closer and closer to where your baby brother is. And then it gets to the point where she actually spies this little basket boat and sends somebody to go and fetch the basket boat and bring it to her. And then imagine her heart just like pounding here. Moses has got a little lid thing, and Pharaoh's daughter opens it and she sees a baby boy. And she sees that it's a Hebrew baby boy because the little boy would have been circumcised. And by all means, she should have taken that baby and she should have dumped him in the river, because her father, the powerful father, had said that that baby was supposed to be killed. But instead, we have Miriam that by faith goes up to him and says, do you want me to get you a midwife? By faith, she runs back and gets Jochebed. And God works this most incredible plan. I mean, I am in awe of this plan of God, that's God took Moses and now puts him back into his household, puts him with Amram and Jochebed. I was just researching the weaning time. In those time, it was around about 3 years, because they didn't have baby formula and they didn't have fridges to be able to keep the milk from going off. So maybe that's now a rough guesstimate, they had 3 years where they could have this baby in their home, and they were being paid for it, Nochal, and they could place a foundation of faith into this baby boy. I just think, amazing, amazing God. And how often, moms and dads, we want to just hold on to our kids. We're so scared of what's going to happen. We just want to, we want to keep them. And sometimes the faith comes in risking and in letting them go and allowing God's plan to come about. God's incredible, just doesn't make sense plan often. We have to let go and trust God for his plan in our lives. I think Pete was talking about also about parents, about things being the center. Sometimes our parents can be the center. They're not the center. Our children can be the center of our lives. But they're not to be the center. God is the center. His plan, his purposes, not our children. And he has something beautiful that he wants to work in their lives. So I just want to speak a little bit about faith to parents, just digress a bit. That you may feel like a no-name nobody, like Amran and Jochebed, who are there in the Hebrews 11 portion with no name. But God has blessed you with a child or with children. And you may be full of fear because South Africa, we look at South Africa and know our babies are not being thrown into rivers. But actually there's many fears around parenting in South Africa. We can have fear that our children will become the victims of crime, that they would be raped, that they could be hijacked, that they'll be bullied. We can be fearful that we won't have the finances to bring them up properly, to get them an education. And even when they get an education, will there be employment for them because of the unemployment rate? We can be fearful of the teenage years and just wonder, is my child going to choose for God? Or are they going to get involved in the wrong crowd and just be drawn away into all sorts of horrible things? Parenting requires faith. I've asked God if he can help me just to put strength into us as parents. And I put myself there. I'm by no means out of it. I feel like we are in a marathon. Parenting is a marathon. It's not just a quick spurt. It's a long, long marathon. It starts before the birth of our babies, and it goes all the way, I think, until our child would die one day or we would die before them. And so I feel like we are not even halfway. Our daughter's turning 21 this week. So I think we're not even at Drummond. So I speak really as one who's right in, feel like I'm really right there together with you running this race, and we make mistakes and we feel disqualified. And even in the preaching of this word, you know, I felt God putting his finger on this thing of parenting and on that particular verse, and I wanted to go further, but I felt God going like, this is what I want you to preach on. And I feel disqualified. You feel naked really standing up because we're not perfect parents. And so when I'm saying this, I'm including myself in this thing. So I want to speak first of all to those of Litleys. Think of Lids and all the Litleys that are always around her. But those of us that have the little babies, I want to put little ones from little to 8-ish years old. Those are the ages where you're nurturing them and you're teaching and you're training. Train up the child in the way he should go. That's what Proverbs 22 verse 6 says. He says, train up a child in the way he should go, teaching him to seek God's wisdom and will for his abilities and talents. Even when he is old, he will not depart from it. So the faith comes in seeing that God's plan is the best plan for our kids. And faith comes, or the faith is also knowing that God has made this promise that we cling on to. And the action part is the training. Training, training, training. So I want to urge you, you parents of Litleys, keep on keeping on. Keep on reading the Bible with them at night before going to bed. Age appropriately, there's wonderful range of little Bibles all the way up. Keep on keeping on. Keep on spending time praying together with them. Let prayer become their vocabulary. Let prayer be their language. Let them get into the habit of talking to God. Keep on teaching them manners over and over again. Teach them to say sorry quickly, that they not be children that have resentments and hold on to bitterness. Just teach them to treat others the way that they would want to be treated. Teach them to share their faith at a young age. They give their lives to Jesus. Let them share their faith with their children from a little age. And then I especially want to say, when number 2, 3, 4 comes along, however many you have, I want to urge you not to let the thing slide. We are past that age now, and we can look back and we can see the fruits of where we've kept on keeping on, keeping on. We can see the fruits. Eventually, you start seeing it blossoming. At some point, you just think it's never going to come, but it comes. But I can also see the fruit where we have allowed things to slide, and I can see the fruits of that as well. And I can't go back and undo those things, but I can urge you guys to keep on keeping on. It feels like it's an age when you're in it, but it's a very short time that you've got together with them in that training period of time where your word is like law for them. And just on this, I was reading a blog by Lady Corin Jensen. She speaks on parenting with faith, and she was a lady whose husband died when her two boys were 12 and 13 years old. So she had to parent her children as a single parent through the teenage years and so. And she just, to me, she's got really interesting or very helpful advice. But one of the things she says is that God actually only gave children one command to obey, specifically. And that is Ephesians 6, verse 10. It says, "Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and mother, which is the first commandment with a promise, that it may be well with you, and you may live long on the earth." And what she says is that teaching our children to obey us isn't about us looking good as parents or about having some peace and quiet in the home. It's actually, the fact is that if we train our children to obey us, children that learn to obey their parents are children that learn to obey God. And the principle that she uses, she says, correct your kids first time, every time. So the thing of consistency, not, I'm just tired, I don't feel like doing this time. I'm just going to let this thing slide. Or I'll count to 10 first and then expect them to obey. Or I'll just let the thing slide. And when I get to the point when I'm totally mad, I snap out and on the fifth time then. Because what we're doing is we're showing them that it's okay to disobey parents, but it's okay for you to disobey God 1, 2, 3, 4 times, and then maybe you can get around obeying God. So the importance parenting of keeping on keeping on and of being consistent in your parenting and putting godly principles into your children when they're young. I just want to move on to parents of preteens and teens. We're with you there. We're in the trenches. And this is just actually a period of time I've found with our girls and girls and kids in general. It's actually been a very selfish time. I'm sorry, teenagers. But it's quite a me-focused time, and it's influenced a lot by what peers are saying and that. And we have, it's our role to actually, it becomes more of a guiding role to help our children to choose good and godly decisions themselves. And it actually, for me, it requires more and more faith and more prayer, because you it's happening more at a distance. Not that you're uninvolved by any means, but it's more at a distance. There's more faith, it feels to me like. There comes a point where you've put in to our children, and then eventually we have to actually let go and hold our breath and trust that God will take them further on the journey. But I just want to particularly, we were lent by Michelle and Liz, just a thing. It speaks about keeping your love on, and it's in a number of things. But I've been challenged sometimes. You know, when sometimes your children can hurt you, and it can be a thing that your heart can become hard, and it's a challenge in those instances, or if they disappointed you or whatever, to keep your love on in those times. To keep your love on, be the adult in that circumstance. When it comes to making unpopular decisions, because we actually see further, we see their future, and we want to give them a future and a hope without a baggage, and we make unpopular decisions, and there's attitude in that, I just want to urge us to keep on keeping on in those times, to make the unpopular calls sometimes, even when there's attitude. Not to abdicate and to step back and just become passive in our parenting of our teenagers. The Bible never actually talks about Amram and Jochebed again. But we can look at the fruit of their parenting. If you look at their three children, there was Aaron. None of their children were perfect, and none of ours are. But if you look at Aaron, he became the first priest of Israel. He made a terrible fault, actually, when he gave into the pressure of the people and he made a golden idol, a calf, golden calf for them to worship. But he went on to actually be the first, the first priest, and his children after him were the priesthood of Israel. Secondly, there was Miriam. We've already seen how courageous she was, but she was known as a prophetess, and she led the ladies, and she grabbed tambourine thingy. She grabbed the tambourine after they'd crossed the Red Sea. They were entered into the Promised Land. The waters came and covered over the Egyptians, and she led the ladies in a dance and a song of praise and worship. And then, of course, there's Moses. In Hebrews 11, verse 24 to 27, it says, "By faith Moses, when he had grown up, refused to be known as the son of Pharaoh's daughter. He chose to be mistreated along with the people of God rather than to enjoy the fleeting pleasure of sin. He regarded disgrace for the sake of Christ as of greater value than the treasures of Egypt, because he was looking ahead to his reward. By faith he left Egypt, not fearing the king's anger. He persevered because he saw him who is invisible." Now I was just thinking about this. What made Moses one day, when he's like around 40 years old, what made him that time go to the Israelites when he actually was fully Egyptian? He looked like an Egyptian. He'd been trained up in the way of the Egyptians. He had the pleasures of the palace. He would have had servants running around him. He could indulge in whatever he wanted to. What made him, what constrained him, what made him at some point decide to leave that and go together with his people and be disgraced then? What made him do those things? And I know that there's the sovereignty of God, there's the grace of God, there's the call of God on our lives, that God does these amazing things, that maybe the Spirit of God just awoke something in him then. But I just thinking, you often see in the Bible, God doesn't just like work in a vacuum. He works through people and he works through circumstances. He works through our past. And I wonder, these are just my musings. It's not by any means what's written in the Word. But I wonder if it could have been a song that Jochebed sang over her little boy, a song of faith that she sang over him that just didn't leave him. Or I wonder if it wasn't like a flash of remembrance of Amram coming back after a day of hard graft with maybe a whiplash on his back there, who was crying out to God for a deliverer. We don't know. The Bible doesn't fill in those sort of gaps, but that's just my surmising. What I want to do is, time draws to a close, I just want to charge a few people. I know I've already spoken to the parents, and I'm going to give it another go. I just want to charge us to parent our children with faith. And I want to charge us that we would live lives that model obedience first time, every time to our God. We can't expect something of our children that we ourselves are not doing. Show our children by the way we manage our time and finances that we are investing in an unseen kingdom. The world is saying, invest here. Use your money here. Kids want to do this and that and that and that, and can always be asking for money. But actually show them that we value something more than this world. We value our king and his kingdom, and we're living on mission. And pray without ceasing. Don't give up praying. Pray and pray and pray for your kids and for his plans and purposes and for fruitfulness in their lives into eternity. And I just want to talk to predominantly this bunch here, the young people. Our kids are in Kidsmen, but I know you've scattered all over. But young people, I want to charge you, don't make the life of your parents difficult. you didn't come out of your mother's uterus with a manual there. I checked because I did obstetrics. I didn't see a waterproof manual coming out with a baby. So you didn't come with a manual saying this is how you do it. They are trying. They are learning. They're learning from the Bible. They're learning from God. They're learning from other people that are just one step ahead of them in this thing. They are trying. So help them in the journey along the way. They're not out to spoil your fun. They're often seeing, they're scoping further than what you can see, and they're wanting to give you a future and a hope. They're wanting to give you a life where you don't have to have a whole lot of stories and a whole lot of mess-ups and mistakes that you've made that have to be healed. They're wanting to spare you from that thing. They want you to remain in God's love. They're wanting you to choose God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. I pray that you would be like Moses, that saw the fleeting pleasures of sin for what it is. That they might look appealing now, but there's a hook and there's a price to pay. And my prayer over you is that you would see the fleeting pleasures of sin for what they are, fleeting and harmful, and that you would choose God's way above that. And that you would live with the invisible one in constant view. Live 24/7 with the invisible one in constant view. And then just to all of us that feel like no-name nobodies, like Amran and Jochebed, that there they are in the hall of faith, but we don't even know their names, but they're there. And many of you might feel like you're no-name nobodies, but I want to encourage you and urge you that your faith can make a difference. That faith that sees God rather than the circumstances, faith that sees how God sees things will make a difference. Faith that sees and then acts on what it sees, and faith that risks and overcomes fear, that our faith can make a difference. Thank you.